Here's a sample of a free podcast from the Post Wrestling Cafe. $6 gets you through the door at postwrestlingcafe.com.
All right, buckle up. It's time for season two of WWE Unreal. Unreal will this season be? That is the question we aim to ask over the next several weeks as we go through five episodes taking us to the underbelly of WWE.
Five episode season, similar to the first season.
Yes, yes. Same number of episodes, same cast, same crew. All your favorites are back, with a few additions, maybe. Maybe a few more voices than season one.
I guess so, yeah. I guess so. Sure, similar. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How many clips and stories were you inundated of everyone taking everything from these five episodes and repurposing today? It was on Reddit. It was on X. On Blue Sky.
I didn't really do much browsing today, so I have no idea, actually.
Well, there was just plenty of
What are people talking about most?
I don't have a good sense of what I guess there was a lot of people were posting clips of like the writer's room scenes. There was one circulating a lot around I don't know. I've only seen him in clip form, but I don't think this season's going to be too kind to Road Dogg. Like, he really comes across as like either like corporate shill in the R-Truth trailer or just aloof in the creator's room and very emotional.
Okay. All right. So I'm looking forward
we'll
to
see.
That.
I want to watch him in the full context, but that is not going to be, I don't think there was any Road Dogg in this first episode that we're going to get into. We went through season one, and I guess going into this one, like, was this something that as we got a little closer you were interested to sit down and look at these? Did you leave with a positive view of season one, a negative view, or do you think that it accomplished what it set out to do, which is kind of take people to a WWE curated version of what is considered behind the scenes?
Right. I guess a lot of
Did you have any interest
I'm just,
in watching
I'm just
this
processing
this
the question because I thought it was I thought you know it was a very specific question. So did it achieve what it set out to do? I mean, what I think it achieved to do, or what it set out to do, was to have it be its own drive to survive. And what exactly does that mean? That means
I would say drive to survive. This is not some phenomenon that.
Well, what is a drive to survive to you?
To me, drive to survive is the apex of this type of programming that completely penetrates through a chosen industry and leaps into the pop culture and brings an industry to a whole nother level of popularity. Like, this WWE is no more popular because of this series.
You're right. But you're more so talking about the effect of Drive to Survive, right? Which I'm sure this one, you know, wants to be. But even in conception, Drive to Survive really just is a way to introduce the sport of F1 to an audience through a very different way than F1 has traditionally been introduced to a new audience. And typically F1 has only been introduced to audience through the sport itself, right? The actual sort of competition itself, the broadcast. Drive to Survive instead introduces F1 by creating these sort of like half reality show / half documentary types of like, you know, vignettes into the stories of the cast of the season, and as a way to like get somebody who might not necessarily be into the sport but is into documentary style reality TV, then I felt like WWE Unreal was successful at like creating a set of shows that you can point to say, hey, this is what professional wrestling is. It's not just two people pretend fighting. It's it can be a very rather intricate sort of like design of, you know, like a very complex narrative that takes place in a live setting that can change as a result of audience reactions and various other things. I felt like it did a decent job of like telling telling somebody who's new to all of this that there are certain complexities about it that might not be apparent on the surface. But was it was it satisfying? Well, as somebody who like kind of follows this day to day, they could have certainly done a better job. I think they could have done a better job of like just making the show a bit more compelling as it existed. I thought it was just a bit of a standard sort of chronological storytelling. But a lot of the behind the scenes clips I thought were somewhat novel. So my excitement for this season, to give you a really long winded answer, was like pretty mild, I have to say. I mean, I was curious to see like what adjustments they would make from the season one, but I kind of had a flavor of like, you know, what they were going to present. And maybe to me, a lot of that curiosity was answered in the first season.
And it would seem like they are going to segment these into 6-month chunks and releasing them. I mean, the first season came out at the end of July, and that covered kind of up until WrestleMania last year. And then this is kind of WrestleMania to SummerSlam that will be covered. And at the end of this series, they do announce the next set of episodes will come in the summer that you would presume are going to kind of cover whether it's the last half of 2025, if they go into 2026, but you would think like Cena's retirement will be a major focus of the third season that they put out of episodes. But this one is called No Days Off. And we have essentially several stories going on, all centering around WrestleMania 41. And I would say our main focused upon performer in this episode is Becky Lynch and her return that, yes, only happened at WrestleMania. You could have convinced me this happened years ago, this return. She just feels like she's been back forever. And she came back in April, which, I mean, this was 9 months ago. But, you know, I was going into this, and just because they had played the trailer so heavily on Monday and during Raw, I was going in thinking that episode one was going to be going into the R-Truth stuff, and it really wasn't. And I'll just say overall, I feel that this was, of the stories that they have teased for this season, I think this episode had like, I don't know, I finished this way and I was like, I don't know how much we're going to dissect the show, but I'm sure we will find some discussion points.
Right. Again, I feel like maybe part of the reason they decided to lead with this one was number one, it seems like they're doing a bit of a chronological storytelling again. And that means starting with Backlash coming right off of WrestleMania. And that means Pat McAfee. That means Becky Lynch. I think another part of the reason they probably chose is because, I mean, you're looking for the crossover names that might appeal, again, to somebody who may have just heard of a Pat McAfee, may have just heard of a Becky Lynch through mainstream media appearances, but wouldn't know R-Truth, nor the story of R-Truth, right? So to me, it kind of made sense why they would make those choices, but it wouldn't necessarily appeal to fans like you or I.
So, I mean, the early portion, they go through the relationship between Seth Rollins and Becky Lynch when they first shared that they were a couple together back at WrestleMania 35 in 2019, a bit of history of Seth Rollins in the company. They kind of just, I thought like this, they had a lot to establish who these people were, and they did it pretty effectively in like a span of 5 minutes. And this included footage of their wedding that they had. It was a very tiny wedding that they had in Hawaii that had amazing production value, considering.
I mean, you know, videographers, I suppose, are something people would pay a lot of money for weddings. So, yeah.
And we get into the crux of the episode, and I just found it amusing. I understand that this is that it does, the title applies, but Levesque pushes, in this business, there's no days off. And we go to the graphic of the calendar, and you just look at this calendar, and it's like it's got the Raws, the SmackDowns, and a pay-per-view per month. And I'm just looking at this calendar. I'm like, there's a lot of days off here. There's no house shows. There's nothing in the middle of the week. I understand this is more than just the TVs, but I did find it funny that if you're just watching this and you go to this calendar, it looks like, oh, this ain't so bad. It's like 2 days a week of work.
I guess for him, there are no days off because, I mean, there's a lot of prep that goes into each one of these shows.
Yes, yes. He was. I was waiting for Darren Young to do a cameo here. And he says that WrestleMania ends. Now the focus is on SummerSlam. And that's where all their attention goes toward. And they talk about the rise of Becky Lynch as sort of this, you know, sort of an underling of the four horsewomen, that she was considered like the one that was maybe at the bottom of the pecking order among those four when they began. But in time, you know, she topped all of them in terms of becoming the top performer in the industry for a period of time, headlining WrestleMania and showing the footage of her broken nose in 2018, but that she got burnt out in 2024. And so they paused her contract in May of 2024. And then she was ready to come back nearly a year later at WrestleMania.
Like her contract ended.
They say the contract ended, or yeah. Did they say that they were pausing this because she said when she came back, this is my last contract. It might've been a new deal.
She said when she said she was going to ride out the rest of her contract, then she was going to like basically take time off.
Okay.
And then come back.
So she comes back, and yeah, there is a point in this where she states this is going to be her last contract, that she is, you know, her child is getting older, and there was quite a focus on, you know, here are two performers that, even with the schedule as it is now, I mean, this could be, like, I'm sure, Wei, you would have no problem being on the road with your kids on a weekly basis and taking them around the country. That'd be no problem.
I don't even know if, oh, yeah, of course, yeah. I don't even know if, like, they would have been doing the tour bus thing. They might have just been, like, going back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, they've, you know, it's, you know, they've mentioned that they've taken their child to Saudi Arabia and all these places. But I mean, at the same time, just the fact of like, this is a very unique industry and having both parents that are doing this full time. That's pretty taxing to be doing this at this level. But
I just can't imagine like the lack of stability. I mean, you're really a traveling circus person, right? And I guess your friends would be the people that are in the crew and I guess various other I don't know if there are any other children that actually that are on the road in the same way, but I also don't know how, like, maybe how often like they would bring her on the road, but it can't be that healthy, I have to say.
So the focus is on WrestleMania, and this was interesting because I don't think they ever bring up like what the actual story was here of, you know, if you remember that week of WrestleMania, it was going to be Lyra and Bayley teaming up against Liv Morgan and Raquel Rodriguez. And then Bayley did an interview with Chris Van Vliet that week. And she was indicating like about appearing at WrestleMania or sometimes being overlooked, something to that degree. And she was like, well, when is this going to be airing? And like, intimating that there was something to come that was going to, you know, give fuel to the fire of the people that might think Bayley is underappreciated, because they do the injury angle on SmackDown before the weekend of WrestleMania, where she is ousted from the spot and leads to Lyra needing a surprise partner. And that would be Becky showing up, but they don't really, they don't talk about that aspect of the story at all. But I found that to be, you know, this is just, they're at the sacrifice of time and what you tell. But I think that's a really compelling one. Like, here is one of your seasoned performers that is getting yanked from the big show of the year in service of Becky's comeback here. But they were more focused on this is the Becky return.
If it was the Bayley focus story, I think that would be a really interesting part of it. But that's also a Bayley story doesn't really have...
it's not like it has like a redemption at the end of it either. Yeah. It's like she does this. She does like her character shift later in the year, but it's not as though
it didn't really result in anything. Like,
no, it doesn't resolve itself. Like, this was all about getting Becky on the show and launching this program with Lyra Valkyria, and Bayley's odd woman out.
Yeah.
So so the surprise I found this interesting is that we hear from Paul Levesque, who says that there's nothing wrong with everybody thinking the partner is going to be Becky, and then it turns out to be Becky, and everyone pops anyway, which I think is, you know, especially in modern WWE, I think sometimes, and we will get into this later in the season, there is an obsession about the surprise and no one being able to figure stuff out. I think it's refreshing that you hear something like this from anyone that is, I think, writing pro wrestling, is that I completely agree. Like, sometimes it is, like the Punk example going to AEW, it's like, yes, everyone was expecting Punk and it was a gigantic moment. It wasn't about the surprise. It was about teasing people and then delivering in a big way. And I think that is a way you look at, like, all things can be different. There's a time when you want to do something that no one sees coming, but there's also times when people are expecting something and it's not the worst thing in the world that everyone knows what's coming.
I think in this case, it helped also that, like, the surprise wasn't necessarily Becky, but the fact that Becky was going to be turning the next night,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, yeah.
That's a good point. So, Becky, they focus a lot on just her own anxiety. There is shots of her and Seth preparing for the weeks, months before this match and wondering if she's even going to get cheered when she comes back. And they show, like, Paul Levesque, Tyson Kidd kind of giving her a pep talk beforehand. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you hear this in enough performers that always have that that bit of doubt. Like, it just seems almost like, you know, you're a big star. You're going to come back. It's a surprise. Of course, you're going to get a major reaction. But there's still that thought of, like, what if I don't get that reaction, for instance? So.
Oh, yeah. And I feel like, you know, if you're Becky, you probably, like, that those anxieties might be a bit overblown, but you never know. But if you're Natalia, who I'm sure last night probably felt very similar, unfortunately, that reaction was not great for her return, or at least, like, not the turn, you know? So, like, depending on the level of performer that you are, or maybe even the location, there aren't many performers that are as popular as Becky Lynch. I mean, these are very legitimate, you know, valid concerns.
So she's revealed as the partner, and, you know, it gets over really well. They win the tag titles from Liv and Raquel, and it was an interesting comparison point because before the match, Rue is there and she's all in tears because she's getting separated and has to be taken away from Becky, and Becky's having a tough moment there. But then as soon as the match is over, she's backstage and Rue's holding the belt, and it's just a complete different reaction. And all that is to say that the very next night they run the match back and Liv and Raquel win the belts back, and Becky turns on Lyra. And Lyra recaps this saying, well, what happened was we didn't really go over how the turn was going to go. So it was her hitting me with manhandle slam after manhandle slam after manhandle slam while the crowd cheered. And Becky acknowledges this was not ideal for what you want as a heel turn. But I would say in the modern era, this is more often than not. It's like fans cheer storyline turns. It's like, this is something significant that's happening and you get the one more time chant. And that was the case here. And Becky acquiesced and continued with more manhandle slams. You just kind of roll with it. And that was the case here.
Yeah. I mean, I thought this was a rather interesting case to be presented on a show that is essentially for, like, a non-WWE viewer, right? Like, to me, this was a bit more of a sort of in the weeds discussion of, like, something that, you know, does not go as planned, right? The idea that you could script something, but the audience will turn on it because, well, they think the bad guy doing this heinous act is so cool. And therefore, I felt this to be as much of an admission of failure on the part of, like, you know, Becky and Lyra as I think you would get. But, I mean, I also think, like, it's interesting that it's coming from Becky here because, I mean, she became the man as a result of a very similar attack on Charlotte, if you remember, you know.
That's right. And they were fighting it. Like, they were initially looking at it as that, like, this was going to be Becky turning heel and the audience just, like, refusing it. Like, they were behind Becky. And, I mean, it could go to a larger discussion. Like, overall, like, I think Becky, she plays a really great heel, but is it her best version of herself? Like, I think honestly, like, she was a fantastic babyface. And
but you can't be a babyface forever, right? Everybody needs to be able to flip back and forth in order to work the right opponent.
You do. It's one, though. Like, I don't know if this version of Becky is, like, the level of, like, difference maker that Becky at her peak was. That this is, you know, she kind of just feels like she's a heel. She's a top heel, but
you're giving people a break from that Becky so that they can appreciate
it's been a long break from that Becky.
Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it.
Well, I mean, I'm just I'm looking at this point, like, why was this does this crowd genuinely hate Becky Lynch?
Against the Maxine, no. Against the Lyra, probably no. you know. So it's going to require
and that's an issue. She hasn't really had the baby faces to work with that have been a counter to her. Like Lyra never reached that stature with Becky, and Maxine has not either.
I kind of feel like that's been the whole point of like this heel run thus far this year, is to try to like get a Lyra up, you know, to a certain level. Then like a lot of time spent on getting Maxine up to a certain level. And in the case of Maxine, I would say like probably the wrong candidate, you know, to receive that sort of treatment.
The exception is AJ Lee. Like the audience is very much behind AJ. But again, it makes you wonder, like, is AJ Lee really going to be a long-term fixture here in the company? Like it's been very limited that she has, like, she's done the two matches. That's been it at this point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
January is your month to beat the price increase at the Post Wrestling Cafe. Before our regular tier jumps to $8, you have a chance to lock in the old existing price for all of 2026, but you've got to do it before February 1st. Also this month, we kick off our WWE Unreal Season 2 reviews with weekly releases covering each and every episode. We'll also be looking back at the Okada-Tanahashi feud dating back to 2012 with some of their most famous matches. Plus, Chris Jericho's A Lion's Tale will be the subject of this month's book club. All that and more is yours at postwrestlingcafe.com. So after that, you get the focus on Backlash that Bruce Pritchard, I mean, this should really be the marketing campaign every year. He says, Backlash, it's a pain in the ass to come up with because you peak for WrestleMania. And then we got Backlash.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, again, like it sounds to me like a more of a refreshing, honest, like admission of how difficult a Backlash is to put together, but also like how, I don't know, how tough it can, how sort of like inconsequential it often seems because it's coming off of the show that has so much more like put into it. So, yeah, it often, like, not in recent years, I feel like they've made Backlash like interesting, but like in many years past, Backlash has really just kind of felt like the lazy, you know, WrestleMania rematch show.
Yeah, it kind of is that, but it is where they explain here that because it's the come down from WrestleMania, you can lean into different characters, and whether that's call-ups that they bring back after WrestleMania, or in this case, doing what has usually been like a pretty tried and true angle. That is the color commentator standing up for the play-by-play guy, in this case, Pat McAfee with Michael Cole, and shooting this angle with Gunther, where this was after Gunther's loss to Jey Uso, and putting his hands on Michael Cole and Pat McAfee coming to his aid and getting choked out in what was a really excellent angle that they shot on Raw. And you got kind of Paul Levesque directing the entire thing and how they were going to keep the camera on Pat McAfee for his whole walk to the back and backstage. And they're speaking through Adam Pearce to direct to Pat McAfee to keep selling. They will ruin this if he just stops selling. And this was a really well done angle. If you remember Michael Cole, he comes to the back with McAfee, then he returns and calls the rest of the show on his own. And this ended up being like a really well built up match for Backlash in St. Louis. Like this was like wasn't the main event of the show, but it was like total something very different for Gunther to do coming off of his loss to Jay at WrestleMania.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, the fact that like it's Pat McAfee, who is not necessarily of this world, but somebody who's very famous, and especially, you know, to I guess like a, I don't know,
the face of WWE to some, according to Paul Levesque.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, maybe for a time. Sorry, you're talking about Cole or McAfee?
No, this is Levesque. He said that Pat McAfee is the face of WWE to some people.
Oh, okay, I guess so. Yeah, I guess that could be true. But it makes sense why like he'd be one of the people featured. Now I often wonder, like, knowing that Unreal is a thing, are they booking these shows knowing that the first season of the first episode of Unreal might focus on Backlash? Like, would they do something?
Oh,
like
I think there's a definite emphasis on this show when it comes like the surprise angles, like of. Oh, I don't think the Cena heel turn was done for Netflix, but I think that was a perfect kind of vehicle for this type of a show to then do the behind the scenes of it all and break it down. And I think they wanted to recreate that with Seth Rollins, with Brock's return. And I think absolutely they have that in mind. It might not be the central focus, but I think they definitely are having that in mind of how this will translate to this Netflix series.
Yeah, I wonder. I just wonder, in particular with Backlash, if they knew that the first episode of season two would be focusing on this particular show, would they have thought to put a mainstream act like a Pat McAfee on it?
I don't know. Could have been that, or just, you know, when they're starting to, like, all this footage that they're shooting and understanding, like, what are going to be the compelling five kind of angles for these different episodes leading to SummerSlam. And doing one on Pat McAfee, it makes a lot of sense here. So they show kind of Matt McAfee and going through his own background, coming up through the pre-shows on NXT, and then training at his facility in Indianapolis that looks like a giant church that the man has bought to do all of his production out of. This is just a behemoth of a building that he has, and having the ring set up and working out with Brooks Jensen, the secret sauce to the Pat McAfee match layouts.
That's it, yeah. You also had a scene from the writer's room where they're debating the finish of this one.
Yes.
I mean, they had originally discussed Pat beating Gunther, which... Is that aligned with what, I guess, I don't know how much you would know, but, you know.
I mean, I never heard of McAfee winning this match. I think that, like, to me, it's, I don't know. I watch these writer's room scenes and, like, I'm sure there is some, like, actual discussion points, but I think you always have to watch some of these of, like, you know, are these arguments, are these organic arguments? Is this, like, just... in service of, like, this makes for a compelling debate moment. The idea of Pat McAfee winning this match seemed pretty ludicrous to me.
Hard for me to see the argument for that. Like,
could you imagine that now? Like, granted, he was still a regular with them, but could you imagine, like, today, the guy who's beaten Cena and McAfee's gone off, he's pretty much detached from any regular work with WWE. And this came off so much better in him losing. Like, they are, I can't imagine it was a thought that was really thought of.
Especially since Gunther already lost at Mania.
Yes. Like, that's the thing, is they're making the argument here of, like, this guy's just lost to Jey Uso, and it's like, and now he loses to this guy, and, like, you have these plans in mind that he's going to be winning the title shortly after this. Like, he's going to be beating Jay back for the belt by the summer. So, yeah. I mean, this one made little
sense. In fact, the writer specifically brought up the idea that, like, the commentator would beat this guy, and then he would also have the job now of having to make Gunther seem intimidating after he had already beaten him, which would have been a very difficult task.
It would have been, yeah, it was... They certainly went with the superior option here. I can't imagine it was a seriously debated ending that they could have gone with. But, I mean, we have seen crazy finishes at times. It's funny. Pat McAfee is talking about the, I guess, seven matches that he has had, and we get a shot of Adam Cole in NXT. And then we just cut to the beer bash. Well, we see him with Austin Theory. And then we see him chugging beers with Steve Austin. And we missed a match, a WrestleMania match in between there.
Who's that?
The impromptu match with a former chairman, the executive chairman himself. We just went from Austin Theory to Steve Austin and the beer bash. And we didn't get any in between there. I guess they didn't have enough time to talk about him.
That's too real.
I guess that's too real for Unreal. Yeah. This is where, they discuss the potential of Pat beating Gunther. And Levesque is giving Pat McAfee words of advice and says, hey, if you get winded out there, just he'll work around you. Dude, you can tell Paul Levesque, like, this is my favorite toy. This is Gunther. He can do anything, okay? Yeah. You just tell him, he'll do it. He's the best. Yeah. Like, it really stands out. And I don't think, like, you can just see this guy of Paul Levesque's pet projects, like from the second that Gunther came over to NXT from NXT UK. You can see he has seen Gunther as his, well, one of his major projects.
You know, he was watching Joey Janela's Spring Break with his match against PCO, and he was going crazy. Then he stuck around for the Great Sasuke doing karaoke too, I'm sure.
Yeah, then he saw this guy like really get into shape, and he was like, all right, all right. So, yeah, and afterwards, it's fine. LeBec is speaking with Gunther and says, you're going to put him over at the end. And he doesn't mean in the match, but rather he's going to give him like a sign of respect. He's like, you know what you're going to do? No, I don't really know. I'll figure it out. And he did it in a... I wasn't the biggest fan of this for the Gunther character, but in the grand scheme of things, it didn't really matter. Well, but
what did he end up doing?
He didn't go and shake his hand, but it's like he made a gesture and kind of nodded at Pat McAfee like a sign of respect. It just does not fit the Gunther character to just like this would be the kind of guy that Gunther would just look so down on. But you can tell like and to the earlier discussion about McAfee going over, they really do value Pat McAfee.
Of course, if
they're looking at like you earn Gunther's respect at the end, like they obviously want Pat McAfee to have credibility with their audience and they don't want him to be some pushover here. Like they booked this guy to be like one of your major baby faces on this show. Like there are plenty of like he's in the sleeper hold. And he fights it to his feet. Like, he fights it more than Cena did. Yeah. Like, he put up more of a fight. And he goes out. He didn't even tap. The referee, like, Pat McAfee was actually handled with more care than John Cena in his retirement with Gunther.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I wonder if, like, you did the rematch now, you know, after, like, doing all that with Cena. I wonder how this match would look. I imagine maybe some of those spots might not look necessarily be the same. But I guess it was a very different Gunther at that point.
I guess so. Like it's, you know, he's like, this is pre Goldberg. This is obviously pre Cena. That was, you know, this match went off really well. I remember them going like 16, 17 minutes and it did work with the crowd. And then they don't focus really on Cena and Orton for this show at all. But they go back to Lyra and Becky, who have their match on the pay-per-view.
Honestly, Cena doesn't, I haven't watched ahead, but in reading the show description, Cena doesn't necessarily seem to feature until like the SummerSlam thing. And even then, I wonder how much of a focus he would be.
Yeah, I mean, he's not really, from what I've only seen this one episode, but yeah, it doesn't seem
like... By the way, we're going to be doing this like last season, episode by episode, every single week, so yeah.
So the Lyra-Becky match, it ends where Becky pokes Lyra in the eye, but Lyra still catches her with the cover and pins her, and then Becky immediately attacks Lyra, and LeBec is... you hear Tyson Kidd here doing his best at Joseph Park where he is, sorry, that was too soon. That was too soon because Becky immediately attacks her and LeBec calmly gives some pointers to Becky that you didn't let the pop hit the high before you attacked her. And Lyra seems happy with the match. Becky calls it so-so.
On the one hand, like, you know, like there was a lot of focus on that moment of like Becky attacking too soon. And I think like the purpose of the show is, I mean, they have access to Gorilla Position, they have access to the agents, and like I think they therefore want to really emphasize the role of the producers and the agents in the creation of these matches, and therefore like a mistake like this is going to be a little bit more amplified, you know, as sort of like a crucial part of the match than I really think it was like in execution, but it does give you the sense that they micromanage everything, every little moment. At the same time, it's that micromanaging that like offers the polish, you know, that I think you could say about WWE television that maybe other productions often could use. It does also take away from, I think, organic nature of like certain moments too. That's a criticism that you could put on it. But, you know, this is WWE style. This is Paul Levesque style, you know, like wanting to make sure every single moment is like to his liking.
Yeah. And there's good and bad with that. Like, certainly you can look at the quality control level. Mm-hmm. There's also a certain like over polishing sometimes that can be a complaint of WWE. I mean, in just in terms of just watching this as is, it's like this was not like Becky had been hit by some devastating maneuver. It was a flash pin. And in that sense, like,
it felt real.
Yeah, yeah. It was just like she was frustrated. She got caught. It's not like she was knocked out or anything. And she just attacked her. So,
but the complaint is that you didn't give Lyra her hero shot, you know, which she.
That's it. They're looking at this from the production of such a finish and not from like a realistic standpoint or from that vantage point. It's just a different perspective that they look at it. And Levesque just says the money is having an eye on the long term, which is an interesting one when we are, 2 weeks removed from them apparently like blowing up Mania directions after Reigns and Cody shot their angle at War Games. So the money is in the long term, unless you get a better idea and then you blow those plans up.
Well, that's a tease for season 3, is it not?
Yes. And we get clips from the upcoming season at the end here. So, yeah, the major focus this season is going to be Brock's return at SummerSlam, Seth's Saturday night's main event angle, and the return at SummerSlam, R-Truth, and some Cena and Cody that is mixed in here for their lead up to SummerSlam, and Naomi as well. There is an episode where they do have Naomi address leaving with Sasha Banks in 2022 as well. So that will be featured as well. Those seem to be the major stories that will be covered. This to me, I would imagine, is probably going to be the least impactful episode in terms of like discussion and people focusing on, because I didn't really take a whole lot from this episode beyond, I mean, it was a focus on Pat McAfee, a focus on Becky Lynch, and that was the episode. I didn't come away with this with too much substance from episode 1.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily the type of episode that would make you like say, I have to watch season 2, you know, which I mean, at this point in season 2, I wonder like how much of like new sampling audiences they still might have. I feel like by this point, you kind of know what Unreal is. And if you're on board, you probably like the personalities enough, or at least just like you like this world enough to want to keep watching anyway. But I can understand why they chose Becky and Pat McAfee to lead off this season. Again, they're famous faces. And in the case of Becky, I felt like they did a good job in introducing you to her or telling you her story in a condensed form. I mean, you know, she at this point might be like, I kind of equate it to like Lewis Hamilton in Drive to Survive season 2, where, I mean, you didn't have Lewis Hamilton at all in season 1. He just like Mercedes didn't want to do the show. And he's the most famous person in F1 at that time. So when they got him in, I believe it was either season 2 or 3, I forget. They kind of gave you like a big introduction for people who might have heard or seen Lewis Hamilton's face but didn't exactly know his history in his career. I felt like this was sort of that episode for Becky Lynch, and as an introduction to Becky Lynch in a very condensed form, I thought they did a good job. They told you who she was. She is naturally just incredibly likable, you know, and I think magnetic on the screen. And now you know, like, understood, well, why she is so celebrated and why she's so famous and why she's so popular. But they also told you sort of like her current state in her career, where she admits that she's accomplished everything she needs to. She's just now sort of like in what might be a bit of a bonus round, where she could do things like play heel and help build other stars like Lyra Valkyria, while at the same time, of course, trying to juggle motherhood, which is, you know, all, I think, very relatable for people that might be watching. So in that sense, I thought they did a great job introducing Becky. Again, did it leave you enough intrigue? Like, was there enough like juiciness to this one?
No,
there wasn't. Like, you needed to get into a little bit more controversy to maybe tease people with. Maybe they assumed that, like, you know, the trailer was enough to do that, but I didn't think it was enough. But they did I guess give you an introduction to Colby Lopez as well, who does, you know, I imagine would weave in throughout the season leading up to his worked injury reveal at SummerSlam.
More of CeeLo this season.
CeeLo. Love it. Yeah.
How do you feel? We'll end it here. How do you feel about Paul Levesque? He is the central figure of this show.
I think it'll be really interesting to see. We're talking about this season at a point now where I think his reputation is at its lowest in years. You know, I've heard reports of his face getting booed during this Unreal clip last night on Raw during the commercials. So we're talking about like a time when Levesque's, like, you know, reputation is not good. And you're talking about a year of WWE content that has not been well received at all. So how will this show like, how will he come out of this show, you know, with the audience feeling about him? Certainly, like, in the case of, like, this R-Truth episode, which we'll be talking about next week, I'm very curious to see how he comes across, because I don't know, like, playing the role of management in that particular argument, it's hard for me to, like,
think. Just seeing that, seeing the limited clips from this episode, like, I can tell you that, like, the WWE side does not come across great, and it feels very much like damage control about, like, you know, it's like, it kind of makes you question, like, why they're covering this story, because they don't come out looking that great. Like, in the end, yeah, they bring him back and they get the happy ending here, because obviously if he didn't come back, then we would have no R-Truth in this in this series. So you do have that at the end of it, but
it's like a juicy story. It's one of the most intriguing parts of, well, the past half year.
But right? When we're talking about why is there a negativity toward a Paul Levesque or TKO, and then we're going to hear them, like, nickel and diming their talent, and they were ready to cut one of their most beloved figures because it was going to create, you know,
it's delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't really compute with people. And it just, I think it just, it does enhance that kind of negative sentiment when this guy was, like, in the grand scheme of things, R-Truth is a rounding error in TKO's revenues. But for them, like, they are looking at it from, like, a cost value analysis, and fans don't respond to that.
No. Again, like, if you're strictly talking about business, I mean, I could even understand it, but it doesn't mean, like, the average Netflix viewer will, or the average WWE fan will. So I'm very curious to see how they portray that. He's not very good at answering these sort of questions in a live setting, if he does even answer them in a live setting anymore. So we'll see how he comes across in a tape setting with a production crew that is on his side, where he can field a question like this. I mean, this will be the one place where you might hear him actually talk about that.
Maybe we'll get a whole episode on the Paul shutting down the press conferences to coincide with Brock's return.
Yeah, no, that might be a
That's not going to happen in season 3.
I don't think so.
Well, there you have it, everyone. Those are our thoughts on episode 1. We'll be back each Tuesday doing a review of one of these, so you don't have to speed through these episodes, but because we won't be.
I think each one deserves its own, like, 40-minute discussion. Well, maybe not every single one. Like, this one, maybe we could have sped through, but
This is the last series in the world I could binge through and just watch. Like, I need a week between these episodes.
Yeah, yeah. Especially the Truth one. Maybe, like, the Rollins one, I'm kind of very curious to see. That seems to be, like, the big hook of the season, the Rollins injury one. So I prefer spending my time with these.
So there you go. Episode 2 is The Truth. So that will be next week's show that we will cover. Do catch today's edition, well, Tuesday's edition of The Wellness Policy with Waiting, Jordan Goodman, and Neil Flanagan. Lots of different topics covered, lots of different goals achieved, both on this episode and at large. And
did you listen?
Well, Wei, I was about to listen, but I had a Egg McMuffin from McDonald's, and there was a shell in my sandwich, and it got caught in my throat. And they gave me the wrong order.
Mm. You listened to the most important part, all right? And that's my Egg McMuffin story.
I'm halfway through. I'm halfway through. I'm right at the point that Jordan's about to charge $10,000 for his drum lessons, the drum circle. Yeah. All right, we'll be back on Wednesday. We've got Pollock and Thurston at 1 Eastern and Rewind Dynamite. And hey, freeloaders out there, postwrestlingcafe.com. Goodbye.
Yeah.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL, and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.